Welcome back. It might just be one of the best pickup strategies ever. Spot the target, draw a sketch of the target, approach the target, show the flattering sketch, and boom, they're like putty in your hands. Such has been the MO of a mysterious man known only as the Doodler. Only there's no happy ending to this story. The Doodler has no interest in a date. The Doodler is a serial killer, and the objects of his desire all end up violently stabbed to death in the San Francisco area. It is a case that has flummoxed the police, generations of police, because the Doodler has never been caught. And despite terrorizing the gay community in the 1970s, the case went cold, even though five men had been murdered. But now the case has been reopened, and police think there may be a sixth victim now. They also have new information that puts them, quote, closer than ever before to solving this case. So what do they have now that they didn't have before or that they didn't see before? And what's led them to double the reward for finding the killer? The reporter who helped reopen the case is live with me next. Welcome back to Banfield, a killer who sketched his victims before brutally stabbing them. The man known as the Doodler terrorized San Francisco in the 1970s. At least five victims have been directly linked to him, but some people think that number could be much higher. For nearly 50 years, it looked like we would never know the Doodler's true identity. Now that could be about to change, though. The case has been reopened. The reward has been doubled, and police say they think they may have just found a sixth victim. I'm joined by Kevin Fagan. He is a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle who has covered the case extensively. He also is the host of the podcast called The Doodler, all about this investigation. Thanks so much for being on, Kevin. This is such a fascinating turn to hear that there may be some movement in this now half-century-old case. I'm curious about this potential sixth victim, because as I understand it, the other victims were stabbed. This victim was beaten with a tree branch and a rock. Why did they think they're connected?
Well, the theory is that the Doodler attacked Warren Andrews on a bluff overlooking the ocean in a place called Land's End. And Andrews got up and fought him, and the knife went flying over the cliff, so the Doodler picked up the nearest weapons at hand, which was a rock and a tree branch, and he finished it off.
Wow. Then there's also this contention that five, maybe six victims is actually really undercutting the true number. Some think it's as many as 14 victims. Why is that?
Well, as many as 17, actually. Because you got to remember, this was the early mid-70s when the gay rights movement was exploding in San Francisco. It was also illegal, essentially, to be gay. There were sodomy laws on the books, cross-dressing laws on the books. And a lot of horrible things were happening with gay men. They were getting beaten, more stabbings and shootings and beatings than, you know, I could count when I was doing clip searches. And some of the cops that I talked to back in the day said they'd come in and they couldn't solve them, and they'd shelve them, and they'd come in, they couldn't solve them, they'd shelve them. It was kind of off the hook. That was the time of the Zodiac killer, the Patty Hearst kidnapping, the zebra killings. It was a violent time, and gay men particularly took the brunt of that. It was a time of oppression. So the Doodler found pretty good hunting grounds, actually.
Right, with so few people maybe caring to even put the resources of the authorities on these cases. It's just sort of just so tragic to think of that. The reason that we know about this doodling, because, you know, obviously if the victims all died, how do we know? It turns out there's three people who may have survived this killer. One, a famous Hollywood entertainer of the time, two, a foreign diplomat, and three, a third man who didn't return the calls of the police. Now, I am so fascinated about these men. They didn't want to come forward because they didn't want to be outed as gay. Do we know if they're still alive? Do we know if they have more story to tell? Do we know how much story they told?
The third man, he actually did talk to the police. He was hogtied and attacked and stabbed, and he screamed so loudly that his neighbors chased the Doodler away. He's dead, by all accounts. And the diplomat is still alive. The diplomat doesn't want to talk. The diplomat is still scared. I don't blame him. All these years later, the doodler is probably still alive. And the actor, I have a pretty good idea who the actor is, but he doesn't want to come out of the closet, even all these years later.
What about just to the police, though? I mean, I get it if he doesn't want to talk to you and me, right? But to try to catch someone who did these horrific things and may emerge to do them again, because by our math, you know, he was said to be around 19 to 25 years old. And in the 70s, that would put him in his, you know, 60s or 70s now, perfectly capable. Might those people speak to the police? Are they speaking to the police and are they helping in the case, even if they're not, you know, going public?
The diplomat is. He's talking to the police. He's cooperative. The chief investigator in this case is a guy named Dan Cunningham. He called me three or so years ago, looking for an old Chronicle reporter who'd been the last one to write about this. And I found that reporter, and that reporter soon after died. So I said, Dan, you know, tell me what's going on. And I've been working closely with him as a source since then. He's pushing it hard. He's scraping up new clues. My partner, Mike Taylor, and I scraped up new clues. I have some pretty good hopes that this could actually get brought home soon.
Yeah, well, now you, me, and everybody who's watching this, I think, has that same hope, unless that guy's watching. So as I understand it, and clear this up for me, there was one very, very promising suspect, and the police really thought they had the guy. I'm curious if it was the reticence of the victims who said, don't you dare ask me to come into a public courtroom, not in this climate, or if it was something more than that. And P.S., maybe DNA wasn't sophisticated back then. It sure is now. Where does all of that stand?
There's some promising DNA in this case that has emerged, and that's from what Dan has done and what Mike and I have done. There are some promising tips that have emerged from the podcast that I did, which kind of went international. And so we got a lot of phone calls, a lot of leads coming in. Stitching things together. Dan doesn't want to give away his hand too much, of course, because, you know, if you spill all the details, they're no good in court. But there are, it's looking good. It's looking good.
So, Kevin, they caught the Golden State Killer after decades through genealogy. Do you know if they're even in need of the genealogy? Because the genealogy just gets you to the guy, and then you do the investigation, right? Do they think they might actually have that guy now, and maybe they've got the proof they need for that guy, and they don't need the testimony from the men who don't want to admit that they were victims?
Yeah. Back to your point earlier, the reason they couldn't bring it home is that the evidence wasn't good in this case in terms of the guy getting sloppy. There was no dropped wallet, no dropped license, something like that. And, of course, the three people wouldn't talk. The blood matches were no good. It just couldn't bring it home, but they were pretty sure that they had the right guy back then. One of the sticking points was there was a psychiatrist who called in and said, I've just interviewed your doodler. He's admitted to me that he's the doodler he killed. Come on over and get him. Well, the psychiatrist under law back then could not be used as a witness in this. And, of course, the suspect denied everything, and the investigation ground down. That was it. And Mike and I, we're pretty sure we found the psychiatrist from back then, and he's dead. So he's not around to testify, and no one can find his notes.
Wow. Okay, we're not done this conversation. I'm having you back, my friend. I feel like that you're on to something, and it's, you know, it's starting to quiver and shake. So I hope you'll come back and talk to us a little bit more about this. Thank you so much, Kevin.
Sure. Thank you, Ashley.
Just fascinating. Wow, I can never get enough of that stuff. Okay, so they have been accused of treating their citizens like ATMs, doling out tickets like candy and stuffing the city coffers to the tune of millions. But the hammer is coming down on the police in Brookside, Alabama, or should I say the gavel? Coming up, how a judge has handed them their hat and how a handful of lawyers are getting their revenge. Tomorrow on Morning in America, meet the man who was pulled off a cruise ship in handcuffs after Hertz said he stole their rent-a-car. How he's been fighting this case from his jail cell and why hundreds of others say the same mistake has happened to them. Join Adrian tomorrow morning. you happen to be driving through Brookside, Alabama, just outside of Birmingham, take your foot off the gas and watch your six. That's because the chances of being pulled over for a minor violation there are pretty darn high. Hundreds of people have been docked millions of dollars for little things that you don't even notice, like a slow roll through a stop sign or going 51 in a 50, or God forbid, flicking your bright lights. The city has made an industry of fines and seizures from its citizens to the point where 50% of its budget is coming from regular Joes being made into bad guys. It's gotten so bad that even neighboring sheriffs are shaking their heads. A deep dive into Brookside's ticketing practices by the website AL.com caught the attention of lawmakers, too. And at least one judge has now brought down the gavel, throwing out charges when a prosecutor just, you know, didn't show up to court. In one other case, an Atlanta man was thrown in jail for 5 days and refused a phone call. When his lawyer called the jail, they hang up on him. When he marched right down there to the jail, they blocked him from seeing his client, saying the case was confidential. Let that sink in. You can't see your client. The case is confidential. If you just try to simply figure out which officer has issued you a ticket, good luck. Because the unsigned documents list people like Agent MW or Agent AR or Agent JS. Talk about a throwback to the way the KGB used to do things. Joining me now is Stephen Gravely. He is the lawyer I mentioned who could not only reach his client by phone, he says he was physically menaced by the police when he got to the jail. Okay, I have fully undersold you, Mr. Gravely. You're not only a lawyer, you're also a municipal judge. So, Your Honor, how on earth do the police prevent a lawyer from seeing his client?
They shouldn't. It should never happen. We should be able to get in and see our clients, represent our clients. I didn't even know what he was charged with when I got there. The magistrate didn't know what he was charged with. When I went to see the police, they said it was confidential. Then they asked me to leave. I didn't leave. And I wound up there for about an hour and a half waiting on the municipal judge to come in and to have a bond hearing so that my client could be released from jail.
Okay, lest anybody right now think, well, your client probably did a whole bunch of bad things. Your client's story is repeated over and over and over by so many people who say they didn't even know what they did. And all of a sudden they're facing, you know, 20 charges and thousands in fines and some of them, you know, going into personal bankruptcy. Here's another crazy thing about what happened to your client. He went to court and I guess adjudicated some of the charges against him and then left, you know, because the, you know, case closed. And then after he and another attorney had left the courtroom, the judge found him guilty of 9 more charges without him even being there.
Yes, ma'am.
Cannot be legal.
When we had our bond hearing, we had our bond hearing on 7 charges. Those 7 charges are the charges that we went to court on. When we got into court, we pled so that we could stipulate and take the charges to the county, to Jefferson County, so we could have a jury trial. When we went back 2 weeks later to complete our appearance bond and our appeal bond, I find out that there are now 16 charges. The fines and court costs have gone from $7,410 to almost $16,000. The judge, however, didn't raise the appeal bond. He actually lowered it a little bit. But when you go in, you know, there's 9 more cases you weren't even aware of. And one of them actually happened in another city.
Which is also completely confounding. Yeah. So that's one judge, but another judge had enough of this and said to the, you know, the prosecutor didn't show up. He just dismissed a couple cases. And when the prosecutor said, oh, I had a family emergency, you know, can you put the cases back on the books? They said no. Not only that, they dismissed him with prejudice, which means you can't have another bite at that apple. So I almost want to say, gosh, it sounds like things are getting better there, but are they?
Judge Owens, she's the one who dismissed the cases. Honestly, we went in and there were 2 other cases besides mine. Prosecutor was not there. He filed something later on saying he had a family emergency or some kind of medical emergency. But she dismissed it. She dismissed all of them. She held her ruling. And, you know, that's where it stands now. They're dismissed. And hopefully it sends a message. Hopefully it sends a message that this is not the normal. This is not how things are supposed to work. These are not how things work in my courtrooms. My courtrooms are about helping people get driver's licenses back and helping people get legal on the roads. Mm-hmm. It's not about building mountains people can't climb. That's not what municipal courts are about. Usually municipal courts...
Well, it's also, supposed to be banned for the city budget either, with a bunch of hardworking people who might have rolled through a stop sign. Well, there's a new police chief in town, Henry Irby. We'll see how things go. We'll ask you back if we don't see things getting any better. Stephen Gravely, thanks for being on, Your Honor. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Alrighty. Okay, so traffic violations seem to be the theme, right, of tonight's show, at the end anyway. So here's a trivia question for you. A United States driver was cited for speeding for the very first time in this country back in 1899. How fast was he going? The answer right after this. Okay, welcome back. Before the break, I asked you tonight's trivia question. This is one of my favorites, I have to be honest. A history of speeding. How fast was the first ticketed driver going when he was caught for speeding? It was an American driver. He was cited for the first time in 1899. So, what was his speed? 12 miles an hour. Jacob German was a New York City cab driver, and the speed limit at the time was 8 miles an hour. They even wrote it up. It was a press clipping. But the speed limit was only 8 miles an hour if you were on a straightaway, because it was 4 miles an hour if you were rounding a corner. The best part is Jacob was actually pulled over by a police officer on a bike. They didn't give out paper tickets back then. Instead, he was arrested and imprisoned before being released a few days later. The first paper speeding ticket wasn't given out until 5 years later in Dayton, Ohio. That driver was Harry Myers. He was also doing 12 miles per hour, which begs the question, how did they determine that these two speeders were going 4 miles an hour over the speed limit? I'm just going to leave that one with you. And I'll be right back here again tomorrow night, 10 o'clock Eastern. We'll see you right back here for Banfield.